Walking Meditation by Thich Nhat Hanh. Take my hand. We will walk. We will only walk. We will enjoy our walk without thinking of arriving anywhere. Walk peacefully. Walk happily. Our walk is a peace walk. Our walk is a happiness walk. Then we will learn that there is no peace walk, that peace is the walk, that there is no happiness walk, that happiness is the walk. We walk for ourselves. We walk for everyone, always, hand in hand. Walk and touch peace every moment. Walk and touch happiness every moment. Each step brings a fresh breeze. Each step makes a flower bloom under our feet. Kiss the earth with your feet. Print on earth your love and happiness. Earth will be safe when we feel in us enough safety.
Spring is a busy time for rituals in nature and in culture. And one of the great things about being a Unitarian Universalist is that there's usually a good mix of one's friends around who are as irreverent, as interested as I am, in the pursuit of reinterpreted meaning. Like a multi-denominational chorus line, our religious traditions burst upon the stage in spring. There is so much for me to think about, everything from Lent to Easter eggs to the switching out of two entire regular sets of milk and meat dishes, crockery and utensils for the two other sets of Passover milk and meat dishes, crockery and utensils that are chametz free. Actually, I don't think I find that last one very interesting at all. But this year, I did want to know about Lent. Why, for example, I asked my good friend Dan, do we actually give up things for Lent? Why not add something every day for 40 days? Like, for example, a good joke or a really excellent piece of chocolate. Isn't depriving ourselves for purity's sake somewhat antithetical to the idea of communion with a holy deity who is, after all, supposed to be unconditionally loving? Why the message that we have to be something other than exactly who we are to be worthy? I was appropriating wildly at this point from both Tibetan Buddhism and Stuart Smalley, but nevertheless. And he just looked at me patiently with a look that can only be described as, yes, Susan, that is why I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore. But then he countered with the story of one of our boys, Moses. Good old Moshe, who at 80 years old is semi-retired, out tending his father-in-law's flock, when God, in possibly the worst knock-knock joke ever written, appears to him as a burning bush that doesn't burn up. And when Moses finally gets the punchline, oh, you're God, okay, I get it, tells him he must lead the Jews out of Egypt. And Moses does it, and he does it so faithfully that the Israelites follow him as he leads them for 40 years through the desert, which is quite a feat. I've lived in Israel. It's not a big enough country to get lost in for 40 years. And this particular bunch of Israelites are, shall we say, somewhat hard to manage, spurring a big conference on governance and behavior goals on top of Mount Sinai. Then after all that, God leads them to Mount Nebo, where Moses can see the promised land, just so beautiful there across the River Jordan, and quite promising, actually. But God tells Moses, everyone else is going to cross over, but not you. And Moses dies before he reaches the promised land. That, as my son Ben would say, is messed up. Ben's right. I totally get it why people have a problem with theism. In fact, I think if I reread the Bible more often, I would regard myself as somewhat spiritually unfit if I didn't at least consider giving God a pass. I think maybe that's what I'll give up for Lent next year. But here's the thing. Someone that I consider one of my heroes said something about Moses and the Promised Land. He was a great leader of people through the desert of inequality, racism, and economic justice. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke about looking across into the Promised Land. He said he'd seen it clearly. He said he might not get there himself. And stunningly, he said this the night before he was assassinated. One evening in early January of this year, having just arrived in San Diego a few hours earlier, I was taking a walk along Sunset Cliffs Boulevard. I had my friend's dog with me, and we were both so happy to be walking together that if I also had a tail, I'd have been wagging it too. I was wearing a t-shirt and yoga pants after weeks spent bundled in the countless layers required by life in a tough New Hampshire winter. The sun had just set, but the sky was still light. It wasn't, as sunsets go, prime time, but it was beautiful in a quiet way nonetheless. Was I smiling? Yep. Was I open? I was practically hugging everybody who walked past me. Was I feeling the generosity of spirit, which is the benchmark of my spiritual practice? Yes. Yes, yes, hallelujah, brothers and sisters. Can I get an amen? So, was I prepared for what happened next? Absolutely not. Turning inland from the cliffs, I walked less than a block when I noticed a woman walking toward me down the middle of the cross street. It was a little odd. I mean, who walks down the middle of the street in the near dark? She was charging ahead like someone who either didn't realize cars actually drove in the street or who had assumed that if they did, they would just see her and move around. As she got closer, I noticed she was also talking on her phone. Now, I was also on the phone, which was unusual because I have a strict no-phone policy when I walk. But I had picked up because my husband, who was also traveling at the time, had called, and I wanted to tell him to hang up and call our nanny right away, since I had just talked to the kids, and I knew they were still up and would want to say goodnight to him. So, I have my phone in one hand, my friend's dog on a leash in the other. The woman approaches, raises her voice, and says to me, "Where is Sunset Cliffs?" And I think, "Directions! I've got this." And I kind of scrunch my phone to my neck with my ear so I can sortively point that way, and I smile. The woman looks right past me, still talking on her phone, and I actually still don't know how to describe this, so it actually sounds plausible. Because what happened next was so unexpected and so ridiculously cartoonish that I'm still wondering if she really did it. She made a face at me, which was a combination of like an epic eye roll and a derisive grimace. Like her whole face kind of scrunched up like I smelled bad. And I remember thinking, she must not have seen me point to the cliffs. It's almost dark, after all. Except that then she said, in a tone that can only be described as so angry, that had she the power to turn her words into icicles above my head, they would smash down and impale me with a million sharp pieces. Left? Right? Which way? She yelled. And then she sighed, a big sigh, which translated into, "What an idiot." Now, While this was happening, I was trying to rearrange the phone again and the leash to enable me to gesture more clearly because I thought it was my fault. I thought that had been the problem in the first place. I was also clearing my throat in preparation for repeating myself because I do tend to speak softly, and we were outside after all, and she was on the phone, all while trying to tell my husband to hang on a second. So suffice it to say there was a fair amount of contortionism going on. I raised my voice while I did kind of like a disco kind of hip shimmy with my thumb, and I kind of led the arc of my body skyward, pulling me onto my tiptoes because I really wanted her to get it. I was so desperate to make sure she didn't get lost. And I have to say, I nailed it in my best projected stage voice that way. But she was at this point typing furiously into her phone, I assume trying to use her GPS. She looked up briefly, she rolled her eyes at me again, and she walked away. In a breathless instant, the last few seconds replayed themselves in my head, coalescing into the massive realization that I had obviously neglected to register in my euphoric state, that basically I was invisible to her. I had somehow failed to give her the information she wanted in the way that she wanted it, and she was done with me. And then I completely lost it. I knew it was going to happen 1 second before it did. I couldn't stop it. Out of my mouth came the most derisive, rage-filled shriek that I have ever used with a stranger. And by the way, you're welcome. Except it sounded a lot worse than that because I don't want to hurt your eardrums because the microphone is here. You would not have recognized me. I actually screamed this at her. And I was gearing up to shout something about her not even saying excuse me or please, but she sort of looked up briefly, confirmed herself that I was as idiotic as she first surmised, and walked away. My husband was still on the phone, stunned. I sort of mumbled a bit to him about the indignity that I had just suffered, and we wrapped up our call just in time for another wave of rage to hit me. So I was looking uphill, the next 4 blocks ahead of me, all leading up to the mesa of Point Loma, which is that finger-like land formation the locals call the Point, that projects out of San Diego Basin and into the Pacific. I took off attacking the hill in a speed-walking fury, trying to breathe out the anger that had taken over. The first block was all rage. The second block was all about shame. I told myself I was a jerk for being angry, that I should have prevented what had happened. If I had only seen the obvious danger signs, she'd had no manners, she was walking down the middle of the street like she owned it, in the dark. I shouldn't have responded, I should have just walked on by. I was so ashamed of my behavior, and I was ashamed of getting triggered in the first place. I hated how helpless and invisible I felt. I hated how I had let her get to me. I had collided with the rudest woman in the world, and I had acted like a golden retriever puppy welcoming her owner home from a long day. And when she kicked me, I had wiggled up to her and let her do it to me all over again. Block 3 was the self-pity block, with shades of self-righteous indignation, the how dare they stage, and it went something like this. Why is it always me who has to take the high road? I was just trying to help. What kind of world is this becoming? Who treats people like that? This is what I get for being so happy, so open to the entire universe. What is wrong with her anyway? Doesn't she know that people like me have feelings? Who gave her the right to stomp all over mine? It's like I wasn't even fully human. Like I was just some walking, talking machine put there to be her personal concierge. And then the kicker. She acted like her life was more valuable than mine. She acted like I was an object just put there for her needs only. And when I wasn't useful to her, I ceased to exist. I felt a wave of despair following this revelation as I started up the 4th block, the last before the top. I was crying a little and panting as I charged up what is the steepest part of the hill. My walk had basically been ruined. And then, at the crest, it hit me. Hadn't I just spent the last three blocks doing exactly to her what she had done to me? I had criticized her. I had labeled her. I had been just as disgusted by her behavior as she had been of mine. I had judged her as someone inferior to me. I had dismissed her as the cause of my discomfort. And why? Because she'd done something different than I expected her to do, than I had wanted her to do. I had assumed that she would let me help her. She had gotten in the way of all my expectations of what that joyful evening was supposed to be about for me, that it would last, that I could share it with others, that I was a good person and a happy one and a helpful one. I had pushed my version of myself on her and taken her hostage by it. And when she didn't follow my script, I had nothing left except derision and distress. I got to the top of the hill and stood there catching my breath. I turned and looked back down upon the wisps of last oranges and pinks to the southwest, at the deep indigo of the ocean as it met with the sky and made the horizon blur. All of the land and sea sprinkled with the first lights of evening, the twinkling jewels that were houses and boats, winking at me as if I'd just gotten the joke. And I thought to myself, wait for it, it's one of my more profound moments. Oh. I was exactly like her. She hadn't hurt me at all. She had held up a mirror to me, and I had turned away, not wanting to see. How I had lived so many moments in my life, expecting everyone around me, strangers, friends, family, to all be on their best behavior so I wouldn't be uncomfortable. How conditionally I had loved, how entitled I felt to be safely within my own image of myself. Had my happiness really been that propped up and flimsy? What I heard next came up from deep within me, from my guides, and from a place of quiet compassion that was much, much bigger than me. It whispered a very gentle thought, partly audible, partly tactile, but it blew me away. And what it said was, "Susan, you are stronger than your anger. You have access to reserves of kindness and peace that can steady you in the face of uncertainty and loss. Let your vulnerability be your guide." I understood that it was okay that I had felt hurt, but I hadn't been hurt by anything other than my own unwillingness to be kind to her. Dr. King gave the speech that I mentioned at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, where the majority of the city's sanitation and sewage workers had not shown up for work for almost 3 months. They were striking to protest years of discrimination and dangerous working conditions that had led to the deaths of Echol Cole and Robert Walker. On February 1st of that year, the men had been crushed in a mechanical malfunction of a garbage packer, since Memphis City ordinances did not allow black employees to seek shelter from rain anywhere but in the back of their compressor trucks with the garbage. The strike had been violent at times, and yet the striking workers had not given in to union pressure to downplay the racial dimension of the struggle. Because of this, the strike became symbolic of a larger inequality in Memphis, since a disproportionate number of its black citizens lived in poverty. Striking workers carried signs that said, "I am a man," emblematic of liberation against the racial slurs that kept black men seen in a lower social status. It's been 46 years and 10 days since Dr. King gave that speech, So we really don't need to stretch the limits of our imagination to understand what it might feel like to be Moses after wandering for 40 years in the desert. To see the holy made real right over there, just across the river, so clearly that we can reach out and touch it. We live this every day in our families, our communities, in our country. All over the world, people just like us are looking over at their own promised lands and wondering if they'll ever get across. Most days, as I have begun to practice this new way of living, the not taking everything so personally, I feel a little bit like a baby deer learning to walk. It is a new, tentative, wobbly way to live. I stumble a lot. But one thing I know for sure, I will pray for that woman's health, happiness, and prosperity for the rest of my life. She wasn't a stranger to me at all. She was the angel who, with her own pain and struggle, held up the archway to my deliverance into freedom. I like to think that that evening, as I stood there catching my breath at the top of the hill in the instantaneous revelation of my own deliverance, I was looking through that archway down into my own promised land. And the archway was engraved with this: like anybody, I would like to live, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. If we never get across, is it worth it to keep on walking? This perfectly imperfect world we live in will force us up against that question over and over and over again. But back up just a little bit, and you will see that here at least, at Fuse, and in our UU faith at large, I believe we're saying yes. Yes. Let's keep walking.